on the field and feared by his opponents, Kenny Easley sported a hard-hitting style in the Seattle Seahawks secondary, en route to claiming 5 trips to the Pro Bowl, 4 first-team All-Pro selections, the 1981 Defensive Rookie of the Year, and the 1984 Defensive Player of the Year. Yet one of the best safeties of the 1980s had gotten little recognition in regards to the Hall of Fame. That changed on February 4th. Nearly 3 decades after his career was curtailed by illness, and a mere 6 months following a triple bypass, Easley got the notice that few football players are privileged to receive. Well, first and foremost, Kenny, a tremendous congratulations to you on making the Pro Football Hall of Fame. What a thrill it must have been, especially considering how long of a wait. Take us through that day, the Saturday before the Super Bowl, when you got notification that you were indeed elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Well, it was a little anxiety going on, but I kind of felt that it was my season, you know. Sort of been out there for 20 years or more, you know, sort of hoping that one day it would happen. But it was sort of like Christmas, you know. You remember when you were a child, all of that anxiety and angst, you know, built up at night as you slept and, you know, just anticipating the next day Santa Claus is going to bring those toys and you can get down and get it to it, you know. And when David Baker knocked on the door, you know, that was sort of the feeling, you know. Trying to get into the toys, Santa Claus had come, and you know, once you open all the packages, you know, everything was all right with the world. So when David, you know, knocked on that door, it was unmistakable that it was a knock of David Baker. You know, I don't know if you've seen Big Dave. You know, Dave's about 6'7", 6'8", 400 pounds. So when he knocks on your door, it's a knock of a distinction. And when I opened the door, my family was in the background, and they were happy. You know, I sort of had a feeling of relief. I knew that I was now a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and all of the trappings and things that went along with it. And so, you know, I was very grateful. I was very grateful, as I told my fellow teammates later in the day, you know, my soul cried out hallelujah when I got that knot. So it was definitely something that I will take with me forever. Mm-hmm.
That was, of course, a great day. Another great day to look forward to is the ceremony in Canton this coming August. It's very early in the preparation process, but do you have any early thoughts, or maybe you have someone already, who will be presenting you during that ceremony?
Yeah, my high school coach. I'm going to have him do it. I talked to him about right after I got back from Houston and told him that I wanted him to do it because if my dad was still alive, I would probably have him do it in terms of influential people. My father was most influential, and I have to say that my high school coach was the second most influential person in my career as when I was coming through high school. He did a lot of things to aid in my success and my decision making and my career. So I thought it was appropriate to you know, make him the presenter. He was very moved by it, and we've been friends for over 40 years. I mean, I take a look at my friendships. I have two guys that's been my friend for over 40 years, and he's one of those two guys. Mm-hmm.
So you got in after being a senior finalist, and for those not fully aware of the Pro Football Hall of Fame voting process, being a senior finalist or a selection is the equivalent of like being voted in through the Veterans Committee in baseball. But during that preliminary period in which you were eligible for the Hall of Fame, you know, the 5 years after your career had ended and so forth, you were not only never a finalist, you were never a semifinalist. There had to be a point in which you wondered if you'd ever get to this point of being a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, you know, interesting enough, I didn't even think about being a Hall of Famer until 2002. And that was when, after 15 years of isolation from the Seattle Seahawks, I got a call from the new owner administration that they felt that they couldn't put anyone else in the Seahawks Ring of Honor before they put Ken Easley in. And so Paul Allen had asked one of the vice presidents, Gary Wright, to call and see if, you know, if I was amenable to going to the Seahawks Ring of Honor. And that was in 2002. And I said, yeah, you know, look, you know, what went down with the old Seahawks organization, none of those guys are still around anymore. So, you know, it's senseless to, you know, hold a grudge with an organization that really had nothing to do with what it, you know, went down back in the 80s. And so I said, yeah, let's do it. And so we did it on a Monday night football game in CenturyLink Field. And an interesting thing is that after that happened, I had a friend of mine back here in Virginia who said, when we came back to Virginia, he said, you know, congratulations, you're deserving of that that honor with the Seahawks, but you should also be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. He said, I was researching your career, and I noticed that on the 1980s all-decade defensive team, you are the only player on that defense that's not in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And he said that you also deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. And that was the first time that I honestly thought about being in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And there have been, you know, several people lobbying on my behalf, but that was the first time I ever thought about it. So, yeah, I can, you know, honestly tell you that, you know, when I look back, you know, yeah, there were times that I thought that it would never happen because what I found out when I started digging into this Hall of Fame thing was that most of the people thought that I had not played long enough to be considered for the Hall of Fame. So that was what I was up against.
Yeah, I was actually just going to get to that. Longevity was the belief, was the assumption of why you weren't getting in. I mean, you had outstanding seasons, but not enough, I think, originally in the minds of voters. And this is kind of a theme with this class, with Terrell Davis also, the running back for the Broncos in the 90s. Obviously, that idea was kind of put to bed a few weeks ago. What are your thoughts on longevity and prolonged success being a primary factor or significant factor in reaching the Hall of Fame?
I really don't think it should be a criteria. I mean, if you go out and you blow up in 7 years, or you go out and you blow up over 14 years, that doesn't make any difference. I mean, I think if you put the work in and you've done, you know, exceptional work over 7 years or over 14 years, the consideration should be the same. If a guy plays 14 years and he's gone to the Pro Bowl five times or seven times or been All-Pro four or five times, but he's had a nice long career, and a guy played 7 years, and he had five Pro Bowls and four All-Pro seasons and Defensive Player of the Year. Which one has more weight? You know, I think that the Hall of Fame said, the senior committee said, look, guy played 14 years and he's only All-Pro five times, and a guy played 7 years and he's All-Pro five times, and a guy is NFL Defensive Player of the Year and, you know, Rookie of the Year when he came in and so forth, and the other guy is just has longevity, basically 14 years and not many other accomplishments other than maybe four or five Pro Bowls or All-Pro years. I think they made the right decision. I really do. I mean, I just think that you take a look at Terrell Davis's career. A guy played 7 years and had 7,000 yards over 7 years. I mean, my God, you can have a guy to play 14 years and not have 7,000 yards rushing. So I also think that with both Terrell and I going in 2017, that should knock longevity out of the way in terms of being a deterrent for Hall of Famers. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your rookie season, which was a very, very good rookie season in 1981 after being the number four overall pick out of UCLA. But you really seemed to flourish under Chuck Knox, who took over the head coaching duties of the Seattle Seahawks, I think it was in 83, after successful stints with the Rams and Bills. How important was he for you individually as well as for the team?
Well, and thank God for Chuck Knox and his staff coming in, because he brought with him the best defensive brain in the game, in my estimation, and Tom Catlin. Tom Catlin recognized right away what type of talent he had in me, and put me in position to make plays and do what I do best. That was run, hit, and make plays. Unfortunately, in 1986, I turned over my ankle and really bad that I had to, you know, have it repaired and surgically. I was just never the same player after that ankle. I mean, although in 87 I still made the Pro Bowl, but I just didn't feel never felt the same again, because the ankle, even to this day, I mean, 30 some years later, this ankle still hurts me, and like I said, I had it surgically repaired. But Tom Catlin was brilliant in what he did for my career. And like I said, grateful for him, and grateful that Chuck Knox and that defensive staff came in to basically resurrect the team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Defensive Player of the Year Award in 1984, five trips to the Pro Bowl, a member of the All-Decade team in the 80s. During that time, the Seahawks were in the AFC West, different, of course, than where they reside now. In that division, in the early and mid-80s, there were really no breaks for a defensive back, especially trying to defend the pass, whether it was the Chargers earlier in the decade with Air Coryell. The Raiders were in their prime. The Broncos, who eventually got a young John Elway. Talk about those battles in division and how tough they were.
Well, it seemed to me that our toughest rivalry was against Denver. We just seemed to we just seemed to could not beat them up in Denver. Now, we beat them once up there, I believe, but it was tough playing in Denver. We seemed to could play everybody else in the division, including the Raiders, and we never had any problems with Kansas City unless we were playing Kansas City in Kansas City, and we couldn't seem to beat them in Kansas City, and they couldn't beat us in Seattle. We would always seem to split with the Raiders, home and away. San Diego, same thing. We seemed to handle them pretty good. We could beat them in Seattle and beat them in San Diego, but we just could not beat Denver in Denver. And Denver would come into Seattle and occasionally beat us in Seattle. So, you know, back and forth with those guys. John Elway was, you know, was a tough cookie, just like Dan Fouts, another tough cookie. The AFC West was a very, very competitive division back in the 80s. But I would say that Denver probably was the best of the group back in the 80s. And I would say the Raiders were probably second, and we were probably third in the division in terms of wins and losses. But it was a ruckus division, and with some really good games in the AFC West.
Now, your retirement from the league came abruptly in the spring of 1988. I know you were traded to the Phoenix Cardinals at that time, but during a physical, you were diagnosed with a severe kidney disease, and the trade was voided. I know this led to a legal battle between you and the Seahawks, and you had touched on the rift between you and the Seattle Seahawks. Could you explain in more detail what transpired from that?
Well, I would be exposing my book earlier than I want to. I've written extensively about this in the book. Hopefully I can get the book published in August.
Oh, okay, great.
Which corresponds with the induction. But I talk about what went down, because basically for the last 30 years the narrative has been owned by the Seahawks. I mean, they put out what they wanted to have out regarding what happened, which was basically that I was ingesting massive doses of ibuprofen. And that's what caused the problem, and that when I failed the physical, the general manager also said that whatever the reason for Kenny Easley failing the physical had nothing to do with football. It was not football related. That's really the reason why I filed a lawsuit, because I just could not believe that this guy was making that type of pronouncement. So anyway, like I said, I don't want to scoop my book. I want people to go out and buy it and read the real story when the book comes out.
Excellent. What's the, do you have a title yet?
I was asked that question today. I was speaking to a group of kids today at a middle school for Black History Month. And one of the kids asked me that very question. And I tell him what I told you, I'm going to tell you what I told him. I have some titles, but I have yet to decide which I'm going to use.
Okay, well, we certainly look forward to that in August. Now, as far as the recovery from that kidney disease, I mean, how long did it take for you to recover, and how difficult was that process?
unless you've been through a kidney failure, you can't tell anybody, what the process is like. They wouldn't even understand it. Or be able to imagine that. So all I will say in regards to that is that it was a long process. I went through a kidney transplant, which I'm, very grateful that it's still working. And hopefully... it will last for the rest of my life. Probably won't, but that's what I'm hopeful of. So I thank God every day that that it will last as long as I do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, your style of play during your career was a hard-hitting style. And knowing that and knowing what we all know now about head injuries, Would that have changed your playing style if you were playing today, and do you think it would have negatively affected you?
Well, I would have had to change my style of play because the game and the way that the games are refereed today is much different. So that would have been necessary to do if I wanted to stay in the game, and if I didn't want to get fined all every single dollar that they were paying me. I would have had to adjust, but I would not wanted to have played in this era because of the changes in the game and the fact that, you have to be cognizant of head injuries. Back in our day, we played a different game, and we didn't know about the issues surrounding head injuries and head trauma and things of that sort. Concussions and so forth, and we weren't concerned about those issues because those issues were not front and center. I'm glad that they are front and center now, because I wouldn't want to see players have to deal with the type of damage that hitting someone with your head can create. So I'm glad that the league is cognizant of those issues. I understand that that the game has to change because of those type of issues, and it makes sense. Whether I like the way the game is played or not, it makes sense to make or try to legislate a different way the game is played.
Mm-hmm. It still must be enjoyable. Maybe the style isn't as appealing to you, but it still must be enjoyable to see the Seahawks, the way they've played defense, especially in the defensive backfield the last few years with Cam Chancellor, Richard Sherman, and others.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that these guys can still be bankers, I like the way that they do it. I mean, you take a guy like Earl Thomas. I mean, the hit he put on the big tight end from the New England Patriots on, I think, a Monday night football game or a Thursday night game, or when he knocked him out of the game, it was a clean shoulder hit to the chest area. And so you got guys like Earl Thomas who can still be a banger, a serious banger, and do it properly. And so that's good to see, you know. Cam Chancellor, the same thing. You know, Richard's not much of a banger. I mean, he's a quality tackler. But he is more known for his coverage than he is for his thanging, like Earl and Cam.
So one more question for you, Kenny. I know you were heavily involved during the player strike of 1987 as a team representative. As you see it today, obviously the players have received many more luxuries since then in terms of free agency and just general compensation. But from your perspective, do you believe the players have received their just rewards considering how lucrative the NFL is now?
Well, you know, strikes and player strikes or company strikes or whatever. The people who actually go through the strikes and participate in the strikes were affected by the strikes don't really benefit. It's the people that come afterwards that are the recipients of the changes that have taken place because of the strikes. And the players today are the recipients of the work that we put in back in the 80s. And they are the beneficiaries of the money and the attention and the accolades and the way the league is run now. And so that's a good thing. And hopefully they won't have to go through, you know, other strikes. But I'm pretty sure that at some point there's going to be some type of labor dispute that will cause players to go through strikes. And I just hope that the player of the day, because of the money, won't get sidelined, you know, or sidetracked with the money that's out there. Because you're making 15, 16, 18, 19, 20 million, it might be a little bit harder to say, well, I'm going to go out on strike for the betterment of the players that's going to come in 10 to 15 years after I leave the league. Might be a little bit harder to say now than it was back in the 80s when guys were making $50,000 or $30,000 or $40,000, $50,000 a season, and when guys are making $3 and $8 million now, it might be a little bit difficult to say. But if the league is going to continue to prosper, these players now are going to have to make those hard choices if the league is going to continue to prosper. One of the things that I think that the league really needs to do, the players really need to do, is take a look at the retirement plans of the guys that played in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and see if they can't do something to help fix it. Because there are a lot of guys that played in those eras that the retirement plan is awful. Mm-hmm. And they might try to help some of those guys out that are suffering, you know, greatly because of their poorest retirement plan from the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more about that, and certainly I hope the players of today remember what you guys did back now 30 years, certainly laid the groundwork for what we see today. Kenny, once again, congratulations on making the Hall of Fame. Really looking forward to the ceremony in August, as well as your book. Thanks for taking some time out to speak with us. I really appreciate it.
Well, Pleasure's all mine. Thank you very much.
To listen to more episodes, including interviews with Mario Andretti, Ken Burns, and Jack Ham, among others, subscribe to the Profiles in Sports podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and elsewhere. Also, please check out our website, profilesinsports.com, as well as our Facebook page. And lastly, you can follow me on Twitter, @BrianWright86.